thank you very much. Congratulations to the Foundation for putting on an evening on this really important subject. I don't know if you know the story of Nigel Lawson when he was visiting an old people's home as Chancellor. I'm told this is a true story. And he was in conversation with one of the ladies, and the conversation drifted towards politics, so he thought he should say to her, by the way, do you know who I am? To which she replied, no, dear, but I'm sure if you asked a nurse, she'd tell you. Well, dementia in itself is a major problem, but of course even bigger among mental health problems are the problems of depression and crippling anxiety disorders affecting 6 million adults, not to mention the smaller number with psychotic problems and all the children with mental health problems, many of which persist into adulthood. I suppose in the context of today's discussion, one obvious question, we're talking about the role of mental health within the overall NHS, one obvious question is to ask, what proportion of total disability is due to mental illness? And that's the first topic I'll talk about, and the answer appears to be of the order of a half. That's my first point. Next point, of course, is the huge economic cost, which this implies, order of 30 billion a year, half, 2% of the annual GDP. So I think everybody would agree that mental health is a big problem. The issue is what can be done, and that, of course, depends on the effectiveness of treatment. NICE, of course, have guidelines for the treatment of all these conditions, all of which pass their test of effectiveness, but some of which are quite remarkably effective in the sense that they will actually lead to savings to the government that are bigger than the money which is being spent on them. So that's the impressive feature of the opportunities open to us. The depressing feature of the situation we're in is that many of these guidelines are not implemented at all faithfully in tracts of the country, and therefore these treatments, which could be changing people's lives, are not available to people who need them. If you look at the surveys and ask what proportion of the people who in the surveys are found to have a diagnosable mental illness, you will find that only a quarter of them are in treatment, which is a very serious situation, very different from the approach which we have to physical illness in this country. The bright spot is that the government have instituted the programme of improved access to psychological therapy. It's going well and it's being pushed forward under the new government. But even when it's fully rolled out, it won't cover a whole range of problems, which I will mention, but I think Simon will be discussing even more extensively than I will. So when I get to my conclusion, won't surprise you, I'm going to argue that the share of the NHS on mental health should increase. So let me start with the scale of the problem. This is the WHO's analysis of the burden of disease. And as you'll see, if you take a broad concept of mental illness, including depression, other psychiatric conditions, anxiety, psychosis, and Alzheimer's and addictions, you're up to nearly a half of all the health-related disability, the dysfunctioning, which is due to health problems in the community. That is an awful lot. Of course, we are concerned when we think about health not only about the quality of life of people alive, but also about the problem of keeping people alive. So a different measure, which the WHO also put out, takes into account the losses which result from premature death, as well as the losses that result from reduced quality of life of people when they are alive. And then this figure of nearly 50% comes down to 25%, but that's still a lot compared with, for example, the fraction of NHS expenditure on mental health, which is more like 11%. So how do these numbers come about? They obviously come about by forming a view of how much disability there is per case of each condition, times the number of people who have that condition. So here, the estimates of the disability per case are based on clinicians' judgments. But I just want to show you one empirical set of estimates, just to give you a feel, and it somewhat surprised me. It may or may not surprise you. This is from the WHO's World Health Survey, where they ask people a whole battery of questions about their functioning, and then also they are diagnosed for different conditions, and the functioning is regressed on whether or not the person has each condition. And here you can see that if you take many of these chronic physical illnesses, they are half as disabling as depression, as measured on the ICD-10 definition. So depression is it's not surprising that it comes through as a very serious problem for disability, particularly when you multiply it by the prevalence of it. So here's the prevalence of the various mental disorders. This is from the British Psychiatric Morbidity Survey, which is a household survey. People are asked a lot of questions, and from that, through a protocol, a diagnosis is made. It's not people going to the doctor. So you've got the huge weight of people with depression or anxiety disorders, something of the order of 7%, and then much smaller, of course, schizophrenia and dementia. I'd like to say a word about severity, because these include mild as well as moderate and severe. And if you were taking a tighter definition, you might say that at least 10% out of these 19% really should be having some kind of specialist help. They're not recent cases or mild cases. They are really people in severe need. Similarly, if you go to children, this is a different survey, but again, a household survey, you will find that something like 10% are deemed to be sufficiently troubled to need specialist help, either for emotional disorders or for conduct disorders. So it's a multiplication of this prevalence by the severity that gives you the share of the global burden of disease that I started with. Here are some other measures of disease burden. Attendance at GP surgeries, something like 25% are diagnosed with mental illness, and probably, particularly when you've heard Simon speaking, you'll think it should be more than that. incapacity benefits, everybody knows, I think, the figure that nearly a half are recorded as with mental illness, and a lot of back pain is actually surely up in the head. So this is a very big problem, but that doesn't mean to say that we should do anything about it if we can't. But let me give you one more reason for doing something, which is, of course, the economic cost. These are calculations of the loss of output resulting from people not being able to work or having sickness absence or reduced earnings because of mental health problems. Something like 30 billion a year, which is, roughly speaking, 2% of our national income. The NHS is spending 11 billion on mental health, which is about 11% of total NHS expenditure. But of course, other services provided by the NHS are probably being provided to people who are there because they have mental health problems which haven't been identified properly treated. So that's another item we can't put a number on. And then, of course, There are all the social costs of child mental illness going through into educational failure, crime, poor parenting, and so on. One could try putting numbers there, but I don't want to spend your time on it. You can see these are big, big items in our community. Okay, so it's a big problem, but what can we do? Well, there are cost-effective treatments, as I say, recommended by NICE, medication and psychological therapies. I'll just give you these two examples, because these are two examples of therapies which, on all the evidence that we have, both from trials and from their usage in the field, are paying for themselves. This is cognitive behavioral therapy for adult depression and anxiety disorders. Recovery rate in the field, 40% above natural recovery, and higher than that, of course, in trials. Savings, you've got two lots of savings. You've got the savings on benefits and taxes from having people working, which pay for the NHS costs, but unfortunately go to the Department of Work and Pensions and the revenue. But there's also, obviously, savings on other healthcare costs. Now, we don't have any evidence, good evidence about that in Britain, certainly not scaled up. But there have been 28 trials in the States of cognitive behavioural therapy in which they have collected evidence on, and these are randomised controlled trials, in which they collect evidence on the expenditure on the therapy and the subsequent expenditure of that patient on other forms of healthcare. And in 26 of the 28 cases, the average saving on other healthcare costs exceeded the expenditure on the CBT. So that's reasonably good evidence. The second one I put here is parent training for children. Again, good evidence that the savings to the criminal justice system, probably discounted, would pay for the training. And not quite so strong evidence that the savings to the NHS would also exceed the expenditure. So these are well-established, well-researched treatments which would cost us nothing. Unfortunately, they're simply not available on the scale which they need to be, because the NICE guidelines are simply not applied for common mental disorders. It's a very peculiar situation that we have been tolerating for a day, well, ever since NICE guidelines came in. But the treatment of NICE guidelines by commissioners in the case of mental health is completely different from in the case of physical health. That's why we get these very low treatment rates, both for adults with depression and anxiety and for children, where, as I'm sure you know, the hurdle to get your child treated by CAMHS services is very, very high at the moment. The contrast with physical illness, I plucked that number out of somebody's article, and I'm sure every condition is different, but in general, people who have chronic physical illnesses are in treatment, and people with chronic mental health illnesses are not in treatment. It's as simple as that. And the reason is lack of facilities, lack of commissioning, and, of course, lack of training of people who can work those facilities, lack of GP training in identifying the problem, and, of course, lack of people coming forward because of stigma. But I think if the facilities were there and people knew you could do something, the stigma would be much more likely to disappear than from any other form of anti-stigma policy. Now, fortunately, some of this is changing, and we have our wonderful Improved Access to Psychological Therapy programme to implement the NICE guidelines for adult anxiety and depression by 2014, this has been defined to mean that we have to be able to treat at least 15% of the cases, that in 1 year we have to have enough capacity to treat 15% of the people who would be diagnosed in the survey. That means that you have to have something like 8,000 therapists. We've already trained half of them, so that's in good progress. And the steady state cost is a bit less than half a billion. But as you'll be hearing later, there are an awful lot of things which will not be covered by this programme in terms of increased capacity. I mean, they're there in headings, but there's no money for them. So we're talking about medically unexplained symptoms, a quite huge problem. I think 50% of cases referred for secondary acute care, medically unexplained, just extraordinary. In 4 years' time, we will be trying to get somewhere with that, but we won't have got very far. Chronic physical illness and the mental health problems of those people, which are not only bad for their minds, but also bad for their bodies, and the children's problem that I mentioned already. We will not have increased our capacity in those areas very much under existing plans. It needs some big further decisions to be made if that's to be adequately handled. Which brings me to my conclusions. So let me tell you where the money goes. You can see where the money is going. A fairly small amount to children, more like something like 750 million. And what goes for adults is mainly going on people with psychotic or near psychotic conditions, either in the wards or in community mental health teams, in the care of outpatient clinics, but not most of them, people suffering from the common mental disorders or from unexplained symptoms, etc., etc. That's where the money is going, and then on old people. So let me come to my conclusion. So if we're thinking about where are we in the NHS, I think this is how we should think about it. We are going to have extra spending. I mean, that was the great decision which David Nicholson made. We must have extra spending to meet the unmet needs and the new needs. And therefore, since the total expenditure in the NHS real terms is flat, we've got to have cuts to finance the extra spending. So what do we need in terms of extra spending on mental health? Well, as I've said, if we think about the unmet need that's there as of now, it includes medically unexplained symptoms, the needs of the chronically ill, and children. And then I've added research, because mental health research is only getting about 5% of medical research budgets, which is a bit small. If it's 25% of dahlias, etc., and there are effective treatments available to be researched. So I think if you looked at those unmet needs and you thought what proportion of the total, how big are they relative to what's already being provided, you would have to say those unmet needs are bigger in mental health in relative terms than they are in the rest of the health service. So it's an area where there's a lot of unmet need to be addressed. What about the new need, which is talked about rather more? They talk about demography and technology. When they talk about demography, the main thing they mean is dementia, the growth of dementia in the community due to ageing. So that, again, is an area where, if you look at the new need as a fraction of total health provision, it's bigger in mental health than in physical health. So it seems to me a pretty strong case for saying that mental health needs a disproportionate share of the extra spending. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. This is the main point of my talk. I hope I am. if we're talking about the we're talking about the share of mental health within the total NHS, and obviously, if we thought that its spending should rise more than the spending on physical health to meet unmet new needs, that means that its total share of spending has to go up. The only remaining issue is what is its proper share in cuts? The cuts to finance it. Well, let me read you. This is a letter that went out from Monitor now about a year ago. And I think things have moved on a bit, but it tells you a little about how the automatic thought processes of people in the health service. So first it's talked about acute providers. Then it says mental health providers face a different set of risks to those in the acute sector. Historically, during periods of financial pressure in the healthcare system, expenditure on mental health activity has fallen more rapidly than expenditure in other areas to reflect this risk, etc., etc. It's just assumed. If money's short, what do you cut mental health. I mean, it's just what you do. Well, it's difficult to see why the cuts in mental health expenditure should be disproportionate, why there's any more obvious room for efficiency savings in mental health than in physical health. So if you put these two statements together, that there needs to be an increase in the share, the mental health share of the extra spending needs to be disproportionate, and its share of cuts should not be disproportionate, you arrive at the final conclusion that the share of mental health in the total should rise, which I think is what they call the QED. Thank you.